I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley. This is the Golster Magazine Show and podcast, and today we have a timely and special expert guest, because the recent report by Lord Darcy made sad reading about our National Health Service. And it's not just about the money, it's about how the whole thing is run. And my guest has been thinking about this for decades. How should and can the NHS be changed? We're going to hear his ideas, but I do want everyone, please, to chip in with your own, not the complaints on what's wrong, we've all heard our horror stories, but any ideas of how to make it better. Just throw it in, we'll put it to our guest, and we'll discuss it amongst ourselves. So without another moment, welcome Professor Alf Collins to the Golster Magazine Show.
It's lovely to be here, Humphrey. Really, really lovely. I'm Alf Collins. Let's drop the professor. But
all right. Yes, Alf. Okay, and you're not a sir or a lord. We have to go through this.
Oh, God, no.
So we can call you Alf, can we?
Yeah.
Okay, one. And Alf, just to give us an idea, you were the head of an NHS department at some stage. Well, what was that?
I'm a doctor by training, Humphrey. Recently retired from clinical practice, but I spent the last 8 years until the end of December 23 working as the National Clinical Director for Personalised Care in NHS England. So really essentially representing whole person healthcare within the National Health Service alongside my close colleague, James Sanderson.
Oh, and just put that in a little bit more drill down, I say, on it. What is personalised healthcare?
Well, you know, what we often do as clinicians working in the NHS is we think about people as a diagnosis. There are some awful tales about it. Oh, you know, the hip in bed 3, the diabetic in bed 20. So we kind of sometimes default to thinking about people as diagnoses, and then we treat the diagnosis rather than the whole person.
So we should say this is Professor Alf Collins in bed 6, and he hasn't just got a hip thing. He's got a this and he's got a that.
Yeah, he's a whole person, and he's got a life, strangely enough, outside bed 6.
and we're going to get back to that in a moment, but we've just had this report, which has been in all the headlines by Lord Darcy, which was done in just 2 months.
Yeah.
And it made very sad reading. Yeah. About what, because I remember when I was a child or a teenager, somebody said, if ever you need something, you have to crawl to a London hospital. And it seems that that's the place you now need to avoid. So just sum up, what did that report say or what did you take from it?
So Lord Darcy sits in the House of Lords. He has been involved at the most senior level in health policy for 20 years. He worked for Tony Blair. As with an awful lot of the people who work with Tony Blair, he's been brought back by Wes Streeting, the Secretary of State for Health, and asked by Wes Streeting, just as you say, 3 months ago, and he started the report just a couple of months ago, to kind of give the diagnosis for the NHS. Really, it wasn't really a report about how to fix the NHS. It was a report, warts and all, about the state of the NHS. And as you say, it made chastening, really rather sad reading. It was a very, very well-written, well-researched report. Amazing to have done it in 2 months. I guess those of us who are interested in health policy, been involved in health policy for a long time, kind of knew all of it. But we'd not really drawn it all together in our own heads. And this drew it all together. And frankly, there are some pretty appalling statistics in there.
Yeah. And it was, let's separate them, because Golster is about actually trying to stay away from hospital and trying to stay away from drugs. And then there was a lot of the report about waiting lists and all that sort of stuff. And this has been going through your mind for 30 or 40 years, ever since you started being a doctor. What would you say have been your key initiatives or ideas over the decades to improve the NHS in a way perhaps that came out from that report?
So some parts of the report were talking about the phrase patient empowerment, enabling or supporting people to keep well, enabling, supporting people to manage their own health and well-being in their communities, enabling and supporting people if they do develop a longer-term condition to develop the knowledge, skills and confidence to manage that condition and the impact of it, enabling people if they do access health services to become involved in decisions about the right course of action for them. So that's the sort of stuff I've been involved in over the last 20 odd years.
Okay, so keeping that separate, but let's try and get an idea of the number of, if in a utopian world, we all lived as healthily as we could do, how many less people would be going to hospital?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I'm going to kind of crawl around the question.
You can crawl around
it. Give you my response in a couple of minutes. What everybody's talking about now is so-called healthy life years. Yeah, it's all very well, increasing life expectancy. But if that comes at the cost of people gradually deteriorating over time, and that costs a lot of money. So an awful lot of people now are thinking about not just extending life, but extending healthy life years. Broadly speaking, if we can ensure that people keep as well as possible, then there's various reports. There's a report out from the Institute of Public Policy Research today looking at this, and it's talking about £20 billion a year, or £18 billion a year in savings. And there is no doubt that we would save a lot of money if we can support people to keep well.
And you say we support. I don't quite know how to ask this question even. Yeah. Help, audience. I think what I'm saying is why don't we automatically try to keep well?
Yeah. I mean, none of us want to go to hospital. None of us want to get ill, do we? That's just a fact. That said, and it's due to a whole variety of circumstances, it's about our culture. It's about our environment. It's about our community. It's about the way we grow up and develop. But there's about a third of the population find it challenging to manage their health and well-being for a whole variety of reasons.
Amongst our audience, if any of you feel that you're part of that third, or if any of you have got out of being that third, just let us know in the chat. Yeah. Let us know your story so that we can refer to it. Carry on, Alf.
I'd be fascinated. And I think we all recognize, there are some people who started smoking early in their lives and have smoked 20, 30 cigarettes a day for life. They know that's not healthy. There's something about the way their life is constructed and the environment they live in and the chances they've had and they have in their lives that means that smoking a cigarette or cigarettes works for them in whatever sense you want to kind of interpret that word works. There are behaviours that we adopt, certainly in terms of how active we are, in terms of our diet and in terms of smoking and alcohol that we know a proportion of the population from very early on in their lives adopt less than healthy behaviours. I would hasten to say that, broadly speaking, it's not their fault. It's not about personal responsibility, broadly speaking. It's about these rather deeper cultural, social, environmental factors there at play.
So you say it's not their fault, but is it not the case that we as individuals are all personally responsible for our own well-being?
To a point. I think, Humphrey, if we were to think of, let's say, a single mum with four children, living on income support, struggling to make ends meet, struggling to get food on the table, struggling to get the children to school, struggling to keep them clean,
Really.
that person may not have that much bandwidth to manage their own health. You know, it's all being used up doing all that stuff.
And then, of course, you've got the children that will be growing up,
right,
continuing that culture.
Right.
And
right.
And that scenario that you just gave, is that that one third you were talking about, or is that a fraction of the
there's
one?
There's a you know, I don't want to stigmatize in any sense or you know, kind of overrepresent. Certainly the third of our population, and you know, I'm drawing on statistics from the so-called patient activation measure. You know, they tend to be more represented in the more deprived communities in this country, yeah, and in other countries too.
So that's almost a sort of bigger cultural thing,
yeah,
that we're talking about, whereas the Darcy report that sort of we're pegging to was about,
yeah,
the NHS,
yeah,
and
yeah,
there,
yeah,
is crossover, of course, that you,
yes,
mentioned. But within the NHS, I mean, we have had people on the show. I always remember Saliha Mahmood, who was the, she was a Master Chef winner, but also a gastroenterologist at St. Mary's Hospital.
That's
and she
brilliant.
said whenever she went to a meeting saying, can't we get these people to eat properly? Because she knew, you know, how to cook it and what happens when it goes down. She got met with stares. And
yeah,
and it was, you know, that's the diabetic, that's the whatever,
yep,
thing, I suppose.
Yep.
So when you've come up with your ideas, particularly when you were a younger man and,
yeah, yeah,
more aspirational, let's say, did you find there were blocks about,
oh, huge,
getting things through?
Huge, huge. I mean, what you know, what I hope that what I've explained, what I've talked about here, is fairly common sense, really, actually, and the evidence to support that common sense view of, you know, what we should be doing as a society to support health and well-being, how the NHS should orient itself to support people to manage their own health and well-being. That's common sense, but it actually takes an awful lot of research to develop the business case,
Right.
I guess, if you, for want of a better phrase, to actually get this stuff done in the NHS. And that business case, frankly, well, those business cases, there's still little holes in the business cases. You know, nothing's tied down. I guess one of the problems, Humphrey, is that hospital-based, drug-based, technical stuff in the NHS, which is what costs a lot of money,
Brilliant.
We've got good data there. We haven't got such fantastic data for some of these, what others might see as rather softer elements of how to support people to keep well in their communities.
So just to take that, I walk into my GP and I say I'm feeling depressed or something,
yeah,
like that. That GP has got data to give me whatever drug deals with depression, but doesn't have data of if I go for a walk or go to the gym.
Right. Well, I mean, interestingly, Humphrey, it's a particular point that has actually been put up by NICE and actually the World Health Organization. For those of you who don't know NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, is the national organization that looks at all this data and makes recommendations or develops guidance as to what we should be doing. I think many of us have known over many years that actually keeping active is just as helpful for mild to moderate depression as are tablets.
Sure.
But actually, the kind of knee-jerk response for many people over the years has been tablets first, activity recommendations around activity second. NICE has now really essentially said that for people with mild to moderate depression, supporting them to become more active is probably more beneficial than taking medicines in the first instance.
And is there the infrastructure? So if I get my, I think Prozac is one of those
antidepressant
drugs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If I get that prescription, I can go down to the pharmacy and I can get the drug. So there's an infrastructure there. But if I'm told to go to the gym or go for a walk or socialize and join a you know, badminton club or whatever it is there the infrastructure to do that?
Great point. It's a really great point. So first off, I think generally as clinicians, we've tended to kind of give people a prescription because it feels more tangible. Well, it is more tangible. Off you go to the chemist, you'll get the prescription, and hopefully you'll take the medicine. That's another piece. Not everybody does by any means. Sort of saying to people, actually getting more active can make a big difference. You know, what are you going to do with that? Yes, okay, doctor, what do you suggest? You know, luckily, over the last few years, within the health system, there are rather lovely people called health coaches who can help you start to think about this in more detail and start to develop action plans for yourself. And there are other people called social prescribing link workers who can link you to walking groups, to peer support, all sorts of local activities. So the infrastructure is there now, but it's only been there over the last 5-6 years, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In some places, there are some places nationally that have had it for 20-30 years, but the national spread has only been there for the last 5 or 6.
And is there a pushback against it, either from the GPs, as you say, it's much more tangible to write a prescription, or from the pharma companies that are not going to get their Prozac sold? Is there pushback there?
And my sense is that because the evidence is so clear, because NICE is now, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence has now pronounced on it, because WHO, the World Health Organization, is saying, actually, do you know what, activity first in general terms? Then I think there's now a general understanding that's the direction we really should be going in. Yeah, that's for people with mild to moderate depression, which is what we started off by talking about.
And the the Darcy report that has all these other things in it, to what extent would what we're talking about now, which is actually staying away from the hospitals and getting a lifestyle going, to what extent would that have impacted on what he says and what he recommended?
Well, it is interesting, actually, you say that. I mean, it is there in the background. I mean, it's really the report, the scope of the report was about what's wrong with the NHS rather than what can we do about it. You know, what's the diagnosis rather than what's the fix? Now, that said, I did mention that there's a think tank called the Institute for Public Policy Research, and it put out a big paper today about what we can do in terms of government policies that can, so things like housing policy, for instance, things like education policy, that can shift in a positive direction the health and well-being of the nation over the next few years. And Lord Darcy was a co-author on the report. So it's interesting. He's had that clearly in the back of his mind as he was writing his NHS diagnosis.
Yes. I mean, we've had on the show a couple of months ago, Lord Crisp, who used to run the NHS. Yeah. Put you on the spot now a little bit, Alf, because, he has, as you might know, health is for the home. You create your health and hospitals are just repairs, which is what we're talking about, which is what Goldster is all about. If you were the head of the NHS and could do what you want, I know that you can't, but you could. How would you change it now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I know Nigel Crisp relatively well, and what Nigel Crisp is saying, what the Institute of Public Policy Research is saying today, they talk about this thing, health creation, which is other people are saying health in all policies, housing, education, etc. What I would do, it's not a million miles away from what everybody else is saying. We do need to shift. We're always going to need an illness service. There's always going to have to be a service there for people who become ill. Yeah. There is no doubt about that. So whatever we do has got to kind of sit alongside that. Now, we need to shift resource insofar as we can from hospitals into communities and into primary care services. Mm. Everyone's saying that.
Yeah, and they have been saying it for many, many years, haven't
many,
they?
Many, many years.
And there's this thing, care in the community, health in the community, right, and all the rest of it. So why hasn't it happened, and how would you do it?
Hospitals, I'm going to tread carefully here. Hospitals hold big data sets. Community and primary care services don't have as much data. So there's an information discrepancy, a data discrepancy between the two. Hospitals have usually got lots and lots of really clever people working in one institution who can use those data sets to improve care, but also in some circumstances to influence the conversations they have with people who pay them. And in the public imagination, of course, we all know, when we tend to think of healthcare, we think about hospitals. That's what we do. And, they do such amazing work. But what they can do is they can use their influence to lever resources to flow into them. And let's be honest, over the last 10, 15 years, the NHS has been set up for chief executives and hospital boards to do precisely that, to be run as you know, institutions that kind of are self-sustaining and are financially sound.
So I just want to go back. You talk about data sets, which to me as a layman, you know, surely if you have somebody in front of you who's, you know, drinking too much, smoking too much, a little overweight, you don't need a data set to tell them to go for a walk and eat better food.
No. But they've got data sets telling us about, you know, how long are people are waiting to come in for their heart operation. They've got data sets. So they're enormously influential. None of this is me challenging any particular institution, any particular board, but it's a fact that they've got such rich data. And of course, the public imagination is, oh my God, we've got so many people waiting for heart operations. How can that possibly be? They need more money. I mean, that's a terribly simplistic overview.
But one of the things Lord Darcy would mention, it's not just about money, it's about how that money is
allocated.
Just to sum up what you said, and I might have got it wrong, is that this is actually, is it a turf funding battle?
I wouldn't say it as a battle. I wouldn't. There are some. What's happened over the last few years is that we've started to move towards what people are calling integrated care systems. So hospitals are sitting alongside primary care services, GP services. They're sitting alongside community services. And they are moving towards a kind of a shared budget and a shared approach to supporting people to keep well and also to manage and treat illness in that particular locality, in that particular area. About 40-odd of them in England.
Yeah. But it's the mindset, I think, because we're, you know, unlike the BBC, for example, the NHS is government controlled, isn't it?
It is.
So there's a political element to it, and that very stark example you just said is heart operations need more money there as opposed to let's fund this walking group.
It feels softer, doesn't it? Even though we absolutely believe in it.
Yes.
And we know that it will make a difference.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a kind of a, oh, really, will it? You know, and you know, because the data is so rich in the hospital.
Yes. And we've got some very interesting comments coming in. I just want to go through them now. This is from, the first one is from Jane, I think we've got here, although my thing always goes all over. My daughter volunteered for SureStart a while back, and they did cookery lessons for those struggling, amongst many other things. Sadly, no more. Has that been shut down? Is that
Well, I'll bring back SureStart. I think there are so many of us who know that that is such a wise use of funds. And I somehow imagine that Wes Streeting's got that on his radar and SureStart will be coming back because it provides, it's clear, the evidence is clear, it makes a difference.
Right. And this Liz says, SureStart provided such wonderful health and education opportunities to families and brought them into local communities. This is exactly what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shame on the last government, that's it, for closing them down. But so did that budget come out of the NHS budget or was it a different budget?
No. In fact, interesting, I would imagine it was centrally funded and it was in local authority budgets. I don't know. Great question. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is them closing down something that, Emma, since its interception in the 1940s, the NHS has faced many struggling. Don't you think it's overdue to revisit the original and something, the original guiding principles of the NHS, which were formed in the context of the needs of a society in the 1940s? Time is overdue to have new guidelines that present. I also prefer as every 10 years, the NHS principle be reviewed to check if it is still relevant. Are the NHS principles ever reviewed, Alf?
Yeah, so there's the NHS Constitution is possibly the closest that we have, which is the Charter for the General Public. And that's currently being reviewed right now, actually. As to whether we deliver on the Charter, we the NHS deliver on the Charter, well, that's, you know, Darcy would say no. Actually, we have not delivered on the Constitution. We've not delivered on the NHS Constitution.
And this idea of this concept, free at the point of delivery, is something that is now being more and more challenged, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought you might bring this up, and others on here might want to think about it. So free at the point of delivery means that, you know, whenever we access healthcare, we don't pay for it. I mean, of course, we do pay for it through national insurance. Yeah. You know, whenever we're ill, we know that the NHS is there for us, or certainly should be. Over the last few years, and it comes and goes in policy debates, people have talked about whether the funding model works. And there's all sorts of to-ing and fro-ing, pretty wrongly thought through to-ing and fro-ing about privatisation. The evidence is really clear. Different funding models, you know, some sort of insurance-based model, they don't produce better value than the current value.
Okay, so it's not about having to pay 5 or 10 quid to go and see the GP.
No, I mean, you know, people have looked at different funding models, really, really good evidence. It doesn't really matter what the funding model is. You still end up paying for it somehow, yeah. And it doesn't improve value.
And you're in touch with colleagues all over the world. And when the Darcy report lands on your desk, and you knew a lot of it anyway, how much worse or better are we than, say, the US or Australia or Canada or France?
It's a worldwide problem. It's a worldwide problem. And, you know, we've slipped down the league tables. There is no doubt about it over the last 12, 13 years. We are by no means world leading, which we were in 2010, 2011. There is a lot of work to do. But the whole kind of challenge of austerity is a worldwide problem. And how to fund a health service is a worldwide problem.
Yeah.
And what I might say is actually, you know, in essentially an insurance-based system like the States, they've got the very best in the world, and they've also got the very worst in the world.
And also, if you get sick in the United States, even if you are insured, it's still going to cost you an arm and a leg, isn't it?
So
you're having to remortgage houses or not do this.
Just as a very brief aside, I was there a few years ago now with my daughter. She got conjunctivitis. I went into a pharmacy with her and said to the pharmacist, can we buy some drops for her eyes? And the pharmacist said, no, you've got to go to the hospital. We ended up with a bill for $2,000. Anyway, yeah.
Whereas here, it wouldn't affect your bank balance, although it might be irritating getting the GP's appointment. You and Grant, getting back to the data set you're doing, data discrepancy, this is in so many other fields. Are IT people being sufficiently engaged to reduce the discrepancies? It says something. And deficits. I've observed quite a few IT people are autistic and may not always read the room well. Generalisation, not everyone.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big problem with data quality across the NHS, there's no doubt. We've got a lot of data, you know, as to whether it's of the highest quality and necessarily represents what's actually going on in the NHS. Well, there's a question. Again, what I would say in hospitals, it tends to be of the much higher quality than out there in primary care and community services.
Yeah, so it's and Emma back again here. This is a good point, actually, that I raised. The NHS seems to be a political instrument. It is.
It's
in every election campaign and Prime Minister's question all the time. Is there a way to leave it out of that?
No. There just isn't. I mean, you know, if you look at some forecasts of increasing public expenditure over the next 20, 30, 40 years, and the leading cause of public expenditure is the NHS, of increases in public expenditure is the NHS. Really? It already costs £188 billion a year.
Yeah.
It's publicly funded. Of course it's political. We've just got to accept that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And which gets me back to the beginning of our conversation. We have a new government in, and there are household name politicians now that came from those very deprived, you know, single mum, four kids sort of scenario. I think Angela Rayner, Wes Streeting, and the raft of other ones that have been through that. Are we likely to get more empathy and more intelligent thinking on getting to that one third of the people that you mentioned?
Yes. I mean, we're already seeing it. I mean, this is not a political, this is not me making a political statement, but yeah, absolutely.
And how might that play itself out then?
Well, I think it's going to play out in a number of different ways. I think particularly this emphasis on personal responsibility, which is actually quite a right wing. You know, you've just got to jolly well sort. I don't want to sound too political here. I'll paraphrase. You've just got to jolly well sort yourself out kind of approach. Is not the kind of approach that works for, let's think about that young woman in the sixth floor of a block of flats with four children. Yeah. You know, so how can we change the context of her life such that it's easier for her to engage with managing her health and well-being rather than expecting her to do it on her own?
Yeah.
And I think the Labour Party is more in that space.
And tell us, Tony, when we talked shortly before the show, you told us what you were doing where you lived in that part of London or part of in going out to people. Tell us how that
works. It's fascinating. So I'm not involved, but it is my general practice. I'm sitting here in Pimlico, and Pimlico in London, for those of you who don't know it, it's very, very right in the middle of the city, next to Westminster. It's got pockets of, you know, wealth, and it's got pockets of deprivation. And by the way, deprivation for me is not a critical term. There are pockets of where the unemployment rate is very high and people are really very poor. And some of those pockets of deprivation, they have not engaged with the general practice over the years. So of course the illness rate is higher there. What they've done over the last few years is they've started to work with really local leaders who live in these communities and supported them to become so-called community health workers. So a lot of the kind of, I guess you might think of it as health maintenance work, like taking people's blood pressures, giving vaccinations, giving simple advice about how to keep well, that's done in the community by community health workers rather than by the primary care team. With the primary care team expecting patients to come to them,
They go to them.
Yeah, there's a lovely phrase, meet people where they are.
Yeah.
And that's precisely what they're doing in some parts of Pimlico.
So then you knock on doors, you can get the blood pressure, you can vaccinate. There's a lot of actually very basic stuff.
Very basic stuff.
You can get done there,
In people's homes, yeah.
Okay, and is your area of Pimlico rare, or is this going on?
It's received a lot of press, actually, because they imported it from Brazil. So the fact it comes from Brazil is kind of, you know, for the newspaper headline writers, oh, that's interesting. So it's received quite a lot of press. They've actually got some really good data, interestingly, that demonstrates some shifts. They're not unique. There are lots of other areas that are doing very similar things, although not precisely the same thing as Pimlico.
Right. Liz asks the thing about data, back to that, are we collecting the right data and are we collecting the data right?
No, we're not.
All the other ones was yes. No.
No, that's a great question, Liz. It's really interesting. In thinking about shifting to community services, thinking about shifting to a more proactive, preventative approach, we're not even measuring the right stuff. We're not even measuring the right stuff at the moment. So we need to figure out what to measure to demonstrate impact and, frankly, value for money.
it just struck me as you said that there's been this big push. You were talking about, you know, heart surgery, and a big push in the past 10 years or so about statins and cholesterol and all that sort of stuff. We all get our cholesterol measured. Is that something, I mean, is that a good thing or is that just a fad?
No, it's a, broadly speaking, the data, so we keep coming back to data. I'm not a good at data.
It's based on data, is it?
We seem to have moved into that place, don't we? The evidence is pretty clear that for a proportion of the population, taking statins does reduce their cardiac risk. There's no doubt. I think there's a slight hesitation I have. So you might say, well, let's give statins to everybody then.
Yeah.
You might say that. But of course, you know, not everybody who's given a prescription for statins actually takes it. And so there's something there about having the right conversation with people about statins
Yes.
that helping them.
It's also a drug, though, isn't it?
It's also a drug. It's
So
also a
if
drug.
you ran a marathon and climbed mountains,
Well,
would your cholesterol go down?
that's what I was going to say. It's having the right conversation with people about managing their cardiac health and, supporting people to come to a decision as to whether to become more active and or to change their diet and or to think about statins. I mean, I think my sense is that broadly speaking, we reach for the prescription pad a little more often than we might. And having that slightly longer conversation about you might want to see a health coach, you might want to see a social prescribing link worker, becoming more active might well be the right thing for you. That perhaps isn't being had
I
as
can
much as we'd
see
like.
the sort of a pattern that we're getting. Is that it is this outreach community health at home thing, to
Yeah, isn't it?
Chris, that is actually the key to helping fix the national health. So Liz says the
Isn't it?
outreach health work sounds fantastic. It must make a difference. Ewan has got something. The How To Academy has just announced a hybrid event, October the 8th. Steve Bartlett and BBC's Tim Spector, How To Be Healthy for Life. So
Oh,
this is
yeah.
something that is, and I think the Times is. Emma, who's in Nottingham, I think, Emma, aren't you? We have a patients participant group to reach out to the community and help with their care needs. And I was elected chairperson.
Oh, it's fantastic, Emma. Good. That's brilliant.
So this is Elizabeth, the reading I did reading around Shawstart suggests that it was not good at reaching people who really needed it. It was do not have access to treat student and not good English speakers and to support for other agencies. So it was good, but not for the right people.
If I might come in there,
Yes.
I'm not aware of the deeper evidence about Surestart, but that's a brilliant point. And in fact, when it comes to an awful lot of ways of thinking about changing the NHS, we tend to, broadly speaking, unless we take care not to do this, we tend to create services for well-educated middle-class people.
Right. Yeah, as
And
opposed to
that's
people
the
that
kind of
can't get
deep
on
thought.
bus, can't speak the language, and your very vivid but sad scenario of the four children, single mum in the high rise. I want to park us there. I'm going to come back to this in a minute, but I want to go to your other sort of expertise, which is sort of the elderly, pain management, chronic conditions, and that sort of thing. I mean, just tell us a little bit about. And it keys in with it a bit because, if I've got arthritis dreadful or some sort of pain, I don't need to go to a hospital. I can manage it. Tell me
Exactly.
about that. Yeah.
So this is a lovely conversation, Humphrey. It really is. I was a pain management consultant for many years. I started off in medicine as a pain management consultant and actually moved that service into the community many years ago. And I re realized very early on that I was seeing people who got unrelieved pain, and many of them had got arthritis. Many of them had got other conditions as well, other painful conditions. And many of them, about half, there wasn't a clear diagnosis, a clear underlying reason for their pain. So they ended up with us. We now know that about 30% of the population live with daily pain. I know more so as we age. It's more common in the most deprived areas. The darker your skin, the more chance you have of living with chronic pain. There's a lot of it about. And about one in eight of the population have got what we call high impact chronic pain. In other words, it really interferes with their quality of life.
And to give us a note, I mean, because is it pain like arthritis, a muscle joint, or is it something else going on inside
Often
you?
the whole undiagnosed pain, we now call it primary pain. We can't find an underlying cause, we call it primary pain. It's just pain. And it's often all over the body, not always, often all over the body. Very often in the back, or the neck, but certainly as well all over the body. How do we support them? And that broadly speaking, drugs don't work, injections don't work. Medical stuff doesn't work. but actually having the right conversation with people, supporting them to understand that the pain for that particular subset of the population, pain without an underlying diagnosis, it's due to a change in the way their nervous system works. Very often they've not been believed because their scans are often normal, their blood tests are normal. So feeling believed, having somebody who empathizes, having somebody who can explain it in a way that makes sense to you, and then helping people know that actually there aren't fixes, but actually starting to focus on things that you enjoy, starting to focus on things in your life that bring you joy, can start to help people develop some sense that they can live well despite the pain.
And you're talking about pain like a really bad toothache. I mean, I'm not saying a toothache, but something that really interrupts your life.
Yeah, I get the metaphor for toothache.
Yeah.
I mean, hurts. Yeah. Something that I mean, you know, some people describe themselves as I am the same thing as pain. Pain is me and I am pain. There's that complete taking over of their world, their entire world.
And with that, and I might be wrong here, but is that where in the States the opioid problem comes from?
It's where it started. And I got really involved in those kind of conversations. I went over the States in the 90s. We knew this was going to happen in the 90s. We knew it was going to happen. Yeah. And there's a few of us in the 90s tried to stop these drugs getting licenses in this country. But hey.
And is it? I've heard about it in the States. Is it a big problem here?
Painkillers. Public Health England did a survey in this country 5 years ago, looking at five so-called dependence-forming medicines, and one of the five was opioids, strong opioids, and it's a problem here. We're just getting over the top of it now, thank goodness, because there's been some good policy work centrally to reduce dependence on opioids.
Okay. I'm just thinking now in my goals to frame of mind and your frame of mind, where we sort of mesh and overlap from time to time. Supposing you have a pain and it's diagnosed, so it's not going to lead to anything worse. It's just a pain.
Yeah.
How would you talk to someone to get them to live with it without them taking even a Panadol?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'd be really interested in them. I'd build some empathy because I'd want to know about them.
This is the person-centered element.
Because the conversation is going to be about helping them manage the impact of the pain, not the pain itself, but the impact on them psychologically and in terms of the way they go about their lives. So the focus of the conversations is to support them to shift from I've got to find a diagnosis through I've got to fix the pain to actually, I can start to see this is about managing the impact.
Okay.
So you hear about the impact, and through supporting them to tell their story, they'll start to tell the story of the things that are important to them, and then shift the conversation to that.
I remember King Charles saying when he was Prince Charles, I think he'd just turned 70, so he said, well, when you get to about my age, things start falling off you.
Yes.
You have to start living with it. So when you go to the 70s, 80s and 90s, the Goldster is interested in, you are going to have an ache and a pain, aren't you?
You are. And core to the kind, there's an underlying theory behind these conversations, which is called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is, part of us as we age, we do have to maintain that kind of psychological flexibility to know, frankly, Humphrey, I'm never going to play football again. I mean, it's a banal example, right? But we start to understand that life is changing, and we've either got to accept what life is bringing to us, or we can't accept it and it can't be treated. Then that's a tough place to be.
Yes, and you must stop moaning, accept it, and get on with life. Is that your?
Not in the.
Not the stop
broadly,
moaning bit, right?
Very broadly, there's the basis from it. It's a Stoic philosophy, but it is about using conversational techniques to support people to start to develop that realization for themselves.
Yes,
for the businesses
yes. I think we've got an interesting one in here from Jane Ricoh. Having suffered from spinal fractures, I've been amazed that no medical person told me to keep walking. And it's taken me 4 years to get a, I do apologize for my thing, to get a, is it, to get a spinal physio appointment, 4 years. Surely data shared between local surgeries could be used to bring people in a similar problem together and talk about what works for them. So 4 years, I mean,
I mean, totally. I'm with you. It's mad, isn't it? Isn't it mad? You know, we know after spinal fracture that ongoing pain is an issue. We know that keeping active is probably the one thing that makes the biggest difference. And yet, you never had that conversation. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Is that common? What we just heard from Jane.
Yeah.
This is getting back to the restructuring the NHS. This is bits of the NHS not talking to each other.
Yeah. Well, that I mean, again, that's part of what West Streeting is talking about now is getting digital systems to talk to each other. Yeah, there's a lot of people talking about AI. You know, frankly, we just need at a very basic level the systems we've got to talk to each other and work
and
a bit quicker.
I mean, because I know I've done stories in Singapore and Taiwan, and in Taiwan, if you get in an accident, they pluck out your card from the thing, they swipe it through. They'll know what operations you've had, what medicine you're on, what your blood group is. We don't have that, do we?
No, we don't. And you would think it would be straightforward, wouldn't you? But, you know, and again, things have changed, but Tony Blair, one of his failed pieces of policy 15, 18 years ago was the national program for IT, and it cost billions and billions and billions and ended up not working. Long time ago. But, you know, data sharing, information sharing across systems is still hard, hard, hard.
Yeah. Yes. No, yes. I think that's, we've got, get back to Shorestart. I saw a different picture. Shorestart Centre set up in a council estate with young families coming in for antenatal advice. West vegetables, fresh vegetables from nearby lot was advice supported many areas of life. An adult educational class on site. It was good to see engagement of the locals.
Lovely.
I've lost that, but that sounds like a sort of,
lovely.
This was a thing that was shut down, wasn't it? And Josie Morgan, the Osteoporosis Society is great for spinal fractures.
Brilliant.
So
brilliant.
The
big charities have got so much to offer, right? Yeah. Especially online. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I think they're, and there's, who's this? Anne Saunders. My mother lived to 105 years and said her only excitement in life was finding out what hurts each morning when she wakes up. Is that a sad Anne?
I think that was meant to raise a giggle. Yes, I'm giggling inappropriately. I'm sorry.
No. I think it's fascinating. So just to it, I want to encapsulate where we've got to actually
on these
two things. It seems we started with this, we have this report about the NHS on its knees, but you and colleagues and people here seem to have an alternative growing, which is actually working in the community, nothing to do really with doctors or surgeons or anything like that.
No.
You've been involved in this now for 30 or 40 years. Has it moved differently? Are mindsets changing?
I think they are, Humphrey. I would love to think it was a gradual progression upwards.
What's stopping it?
An over-reliance on what medicine can do. And that over-reliance is, broadly speaking, uninformed. Medicine can work miracles. It also can't fix everything.
And in Britain, is our culture, our mindset that the NHS should fix everything? That's what we're entitled to?
I don't know of any evidence to suggest that. I've heard it said on so many occasions. Of course, we've got the NHS, and no matter what happens, it'll pay if we get ill. Do we really think like that? Do we really actually think like that? Do we put ourselves at risk because there's an NHS? I literally, I don't know. I'd be interested to hear other views.
Well, I'm sure you've met more. I have met many people that do. They smoke and they drink, and then and then they end up in A&E.
Because are they smoking and drinking because there's a free NHS at the point of delivery? I think there's probably.
I don't know because I mean, I guess it would be interesting to ask that question in, you know, the Rust Belt America, wouldn't it? Because they don't have it free, so it would hit their pocketbooks, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, like you, I've heard it said, and I'm just a little sceptical, you know, to what degree it is a driver of people's behaviours, the fact that there's a free NHS.
Yes, there's Emma here. I love Emma. What do you make of Goldster in the context of its role as a partner to the NHS, or is it a competition?
Yeah, brilliant, isn't it? It's really brilliant. I mean, Wes Streeting, the Secretary of State, has said we've got to shift from a reactive model towards prevention. We've got to shift from face-to-face to digital. We've got to shift from hospitals to communities. You know, digital channels, which I think Goldster is an absolutely prime example as ways of supporting people to keep well. Yeah, they're the future. They really are. It'd be amazing, wouldn't it, to think, where are we going to be in 50 years? Yeah. Probably nearly all going to be online, isn't it? Probably all.
Of course, with things like Goldster, which I've been involved for a number of years now, they don't have the, quotes, data sets.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem, yeah. Yeah, you need, you know, what we talk about is person level data sets following people through. And of course, only the NHS can do that because of, you know, GDPR and all that sort of stuff. And also data linkage. So linkage across various data sets in the NHS. So the NHS is a fabulous ground to figure out what's happening for the health of the population. But, you know, for newcomers, relative newcomers like Goldster, it's hard. It's hard to become established.
And do the GPs have that data set? I mean, or not? Is it just
they I mean, usually they're held at a system level and given to and provided to GPs, although GPs do have data sets for their for their list, the people that they serve. So they keep busy.
I mean, but just before I came on, we were doing it, I was having a conversation with somebody that Goldster sponsored. She's 102 years old, and she did a skydive to raise money for charity. And she says she's blessed with good genes. But she came up with a thing that just now. She's saying, eat healthily.
Yep.
She cooks her own food. And she talked about social a lot.
Yeah.
You know, talk to people, never say no to anything.
Yeah.
How much is that sort of upbeat, purposeful mindset important?
I often talk about what we want, and this goes back to philosophy from thousands of years ago. What we want in our lives is hope. What we want is purpose. What we want is meaning, and what we want is connection. And if we've got hope, purpose, meaning, and connection, that's a pretty good life.
Purpose, even if you've got pain, like the 105-year-old wakes up wondering what pain is.
Right.
Hope, purpose, meaning, and connection.
Yeah.
Okay. So that could be the alternative to the, you know, anesthetic, blood pressure, heart surgery, painkillers.
Pretty good, isn't it?
I'll sit there for a second. I'm going to tell everybody what's coming up next on Goldster, and then I want to come back to you. We have next Tuesday, Lucinda, the Goldster Magazine Show Book Club, Shrines of Gaiety by Kate Atkinson. It is 1926 in a country still recovering from the Great War. A perfect novel for uncertain times, says the Times. October the 1st, Professor Peter Abrahams, and his speciality is clinical anatomy. That's how all our bodies fit together and what arthritis is. Bit of the pain management there, I suspect. But he's also an expert on Michelangelo and how bodies fit together there, and Leonardo da Vinci, who are apparently rivals and not friends. October the 8th, I have it here, Dr. Jennifer Cox, and her book is Women Are Angry. Are you angry? Tell us, put it in the chat right now. Let Goldster know. She says, Jennifer, why your rage is hiding and how to let it out. I am really looking forward to that one. And then October the 15th, Lord Richard Layard, founder of the Action for Happiness campaign. We were just talking about that. The Science of Happiness. We've had Sir Anthony Seldon on about happiness. Now another grandee of the art of happiness joins us on October the 15th. Alf, I've got to ask you this. As a man, are men angry too? Should we co-author a book saying
equally angry men and women together? Chuck two angry people together. What do you get? Oh my word!
Oh my God!
We need to think more about this, don't we?
What are men angry about?
We're surrounded by angry women. That's the problem. Oh God, that sounds desperate.
I heard that a million times. But I'd be fascinated in that interview because, in fact, I had to do one the other day on the, I think it was the 10 principles of the feminine. And I was trying to put it off to Lucinda, but she was busy. So I did it myself and way out of my depth. But on Lord Layard, this and Anthony Seldon, this happiness thing. Was that a little bit about what you were telling us just now?
Yeah, there was. I mean, what they're really into is a sort of a strengths-based approach. You know, how can I engage with my own sense of resourcefulness? And what we tend to do in healthcare is we take a kind of a disease-based approach to life. It's all pretty negative. I love the work of Michael Lowe. I think it's very, 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 it's fascinating and important.
Mm. And to go back to the picture you got of the single mum with the four kids in the high rise, and that third that you said is very difficult to, I mean, happiness, meaning, right. Connection, all of that,
right.
Hope.
Right.
Is that part of those lives at all, or does it have to be?
There's something, isn't there, about what can we do in policy to support people like that to develop hope, meaning, purpose and connection. Almost feels like a kind of a, what we often say is a North Star. We've got that kind of guiding light for how to develop policy.
And
it's not far off the mark.
And some of the things that we've... we've talked about that, the Sure Start thing, the various, the patients group that Emma's the chair of, and that they would be designed to actually give hope and pathway,
right.
Wouldn't they?
Exactly, yeah. exactly.
So you're, and correct me if, or I might get you to say it, sum up for me, this whole conversation, the state of the NHS, the way forward 20 years, 30 years from now, what would you like to see?
I really would like to see, I've brought up hope, meaning, purpose and connection as kind of a set of guiding principles actually for public policy. And there is something about ensuring that public policy is there, not just to provide financial security for people, but to think along these lines. I mean, we did think about happiness a few years ago, interestingly, didn't we? Yeah, happiness, hope, meaning, purpose, connection. Why don't we do more politically to help create the conditions for people to find that within themselves to grow, I guess, really.
And in your conversations amongst doctors, in your local community, amongst local council officials and there, does what you have just advocated to us resonate with them?
Oh, yeah. So, it's not just me. There's lots and lots and lots of people talking like this now. Lots, not just me.
So lots of exercise, lots of parties, lots of hope.
Mostly parties.
And a project in the morning. A reason to get up in the morning.
You're right. Absolutely right. Yeah.
You were my reason to get up this morning, Alf, and we've had a great time. So, but time's winged chariot is upon us. One thing we cannot reform is time. I think we have come up with a new idea. I mean, I'm sure it's around before, but I've got it in mind how to sort of fix or help our health system. Thanks, Alf Collins, for really perking us up and letting us into your ideas, helping us and showing us a way forward. Until next week with Lucinda and the book club conversation. And I forgot to mention, on the 25th of August in one of Lee Pycroft's community shows, we are interviewing Minette Bailey, the 102-year-old who forgot her aches and pains and decided to jump out of an aeroplane. So join for that. show. You'll find it on the Goals website. And until then, stay involved, be generous, keep healthy, keep thinking about how to reform the NHS, and of course, stay Goalster. Let us know how to reform. Thanks, Al.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone.
Really good show. Thank you very much.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to a Goalster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goalster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goalster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.